You're listening to Radio Freethinker, episode 82.
She's not a girl who misses much. Oh, yeah. She's well acquainted with the touch of the velvet hand, like a lizard on a window pane. In the crowd with the multicolored mirrors on his hobnail boots, lying with his eyes while his hands are busy working overtime. A soap impression of his wife, which he ate and donated to the National Trust.
Hello and welcome to Radio Freethinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking, right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. This is Ethan, your freethinking historian and executive director of CFI Vancouver.
And this is Don, Don's not here. This is Daniel, economics student here at UBC and president of the UBC Freethinkers Club.
And I'm Chloe, member of UBC Freethinkers.
It's nice that you almost forgot who you were.
Yeah, I'm so used to hearing I'm Don after I'm Ethan. It's just,
yeah,
it flows naturally.
Right. So, folks, how was your weekend?
Uneventful. Yours?
Uneventful, except for one event. But we'll get to that later. You know, it strikes me that Chloe's been on the show for, I don't know, a couple of weeks now.
That's true.
And you just sort of walked into the show one day and said, well, I'm here. And we didn't really know who you were or anything, so we just kind of went with it. But now that I think about it, we don't know who you are.
Well, would you like to know who I am?
I kind of want to know who you are, yeah.
Well, I'm a creative writing student here at UBC, and I'm also, as I've said, a member of the UBC Freethinkers. I'm sort of a lukewarm community skeptic, even though I'm very skeptical in my head. I don't extend my skepticism beyond my head very often, except for this radio show. I'm very excited to be here because this is, as we all know, Vancouver's number one radio show for skepticism and critical thinking.
That's right.
And that's who I am, Ethan. Now you know.
Oh, okay. So when did you become a skeptic?
I became a skeptic. When did I become a skeptic? That's a very good question.
Have you always been a skeptic?
I've always been very somewhat skeptical. I became very skeptical when I was a teenager, as we're all wont to do as adolescents. But I guess that I sort of became involved in the skeptic community about a year ago through friends of mine who were becoming really, really involved, namely SFU skeptics, of whom I know a great deal. Yes.
Okay, so you decided to become a skeptic, but was there anything that sort of motivated you? Like, for example, were you just sort of really tired of seeing, like, homeopathic medicine being touted as a cure for cancer, or... You know, were you just getting really tired of churches getting tax exempt status, or...
Or were you really tired of people saying Santa's real?
That's not many people claim to me that Santa's real anymore, to be honest. That's a very good question. I think I mostly got tired of people not defining their terms properly in classes that I would take. Although, I have to admit, I grew up in a fairly, I suppose you call it an agnostic household, and skepticism of religion was encouraged, even though a natural curiosity about religion was encouraged. But I suppose as I grew up, yes, I became more skeptical of religion specifically, and that's sort of what led me to be a community skeptic.
So where do you fall in sort of the divide between skepticism, atheism, humanism? Do you consider all of those three things one and the same, or do you sort of compartmentalize those into different categories?
I sort of have trouble with the term humanist, mostly because I, having only taken one philosophy course, I'm not entirely sure what a proper definition of humanism is, aside from the basics. Atheism and skepticism, I don't think, go hand in hand. I know a lot of people who are irrational who are also atheists. So I would say that the skeptical community, while it's composed mostly of atheists, doesn't have to necessarily. And so I wouldn't put them in the same category, to answer your question. I would say they're very distinct in many ways.
Is there anyone in particular that a skeptical person, you know, one of those pseudo-celebrities that we have in the movement, who do you particularly look up to? Or
I'm a big Carl Sagan fan. I like his sense of wonder when it comes to science.
Yeah, I think he's pretty much the number one figure for skepticism, isn't he? Well, thanks, Chloe.
You're welcome.
Thank you. I mentioned an event over the weekend, and here at CFI Vancouver, we became aware that another self-proclaimed psychic and medium, namely James Van Prague, was coming to the River Rock Casino in Richmond to apply his trade on Saturday the 25th. So we thought, well, this is a good opportunity to act out our skepticism, which is skepticism combined with activism. Isn't that clever?
It's very clever.
Yeah. So we at CFI and Radio Freethinker were there to hand out flyers encouraging critical thinking. And if Don was here, he would also agree with me because he was there as well. But he's not here, which is sad. So this is actually our third skepticism event here in Vancouver.
What were the first two, Ethan?
Well, the first
one. Sorry to interrupt.
Well, you're forgiven. The first one was Deepak Chopra. He came to Vancouver to do his Deepakian Chopra stuff, quantum magic powers, universal god type stuff. Anyway, CFI responded, and we actually had about 23 people at that event handing out flyers, had some really interesting conversations, met Deepak Chopra himself.
Wow.
Spoke to his bulldog, Stuart Hameroff, I believe, who has his own little following. He did a talk at the Beyond Belief Symposium a number of years ago, and Lawrence Krauss, who was recently in Vancouver, gave his famous brutal takedown of him on stage. It was just absolutely merciless, and you should YouTube it if you haven't seen it. It's just amazing. Anyway, that's beyond the point. So Deepak was here. We handed out flyers. We even saw the former mayor of Vancouver was attending. Just lots of interesting people. It was a very successful event. I think everyone was really happy with that. We then learned, really at the last minute, thanks to a Twitter message from former Radio Freethinker co-host Rob, that John Edward was coming to town. Now, Edward is sort of known in the skeptical community as being one of the worst, if not the worst, at what he does. He used to host that horrible show, Crossing Over. So he was in town. Last minute, we put together some flyers, went down to where he was speaking, which was over at a hotel in Vancouver, and handed out some flyers. It was quite interesting because one of the attendees offered to give us a spare ticket, but when they learned that we were skeptical, they refused to give us the ticket because our skepticism was going to drive away their ghosts. So unfortunate that we didn't get to see him. But it was a success. Despite the fact that it was last minute, it was a success. Now, with Von Prague, unfortunately, we had a lot of heads up on this, but the challenge was that this was taking place in a casino. And now casinos are designed to be like sort of little fortresses. And by nature, they're designed to protect the anonymity of the people going to them, right? They're not designed to be open and, you know, easy to access. They're designed to be kind of corridor-like and really hard to get around. So this was a huge challenge for us, because how do you set up somewhere getting people who are going to the show and not so much just going to the casino? And so that was the biggest challenge we faced. We tried our best. We ended up setting up in the lobby outside the theater, handing out flyers. That lasted for about 15 minutes before they threw us out. We did manage to get out, I'd say, about 60 or so flyers, which was, I think, decent. One person even told us how she didn't believe what we were saying because she was actually a psychic as well. And I guess
really?
Was coming to check out the competition.
Learned some of the tricks of the trade.
Yeah. So, you know, it was tough. It really wasn't the most shining instance of skepticism. We only had about 7 people there as well. And so when you're dealing with a location the size of River Rock with only about 7 people, it is quite tough. After we were tossed out, casino security came out to us and basically warned us of further action if guests were continuing to be annoyed. So we kind of retreated the public property over on the sidewalk, which was quite far away. But we still managed to get a few more flyers out. And so in that sense, it was kind of a success, although this was probably a bit more rickety than previous efforts. And then afterwards, we went to a restaurant for some drinks and some perhaps planning for future events on ways that we can improve skepticism. So, I mean, it was eventful, but ultimately, I think many of us left feeling a little frustrated by the circumstances.
Would a better method in future have, you know, to have, like, sort of undercover skeptics go into the event and watch it and then report on it afterwards, or hand out flyers afterwards or something?
Well, I mean, the problem with that is they do cost a lot of money, these tickets.
That's true, yes.
I think in Von Prague's case, they were in the area of $50 to $60, depending on where you were sitting. And again, obviously, people going in, if you're a skeptic going in, you're going to be very angry by the time you come out. So it's kind of more like torture to force somebody to go in there.
Yeah. Not to mention, no one wants to give them money.
Exactly, right?
Fair
so that, that's
fair,
one of the
fair.
Problems. An idea that we kind of thought would be a bit more appropriate in this case, because of sort of the labyrinth of River Rock, is maybe setting up something on the street, like a little booth.
Right.
Get like a permit so they can't kick us out, and just sort of let people come to us. I mean, ideally, we want to be a bit more proactive with it, but I think we have to be a bit fluid with our plans when it comes to dealing with these circumstances. Well, why don't we go to a commercial break, actually, and we'll be back with some more on Radio Freethinker.
Hey, we're J+J+J, and I bet you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver.
The sitar.
We call it that. Do you?
You should. Unless you don't like sitars.
CITR has more friends than ever before. We've partnered with tons of local businesses to bring you great discounts in the communities where you live, work, and play. Maybe Main Street is your main drag. Present your Friends of CITR card at Red Cat Records, Lucky's Comics, Devil May Wear, Thriller, Blim, The Kiss Store, The Wallflower Modern Diner, RX Comics, Antisocial Skateboard Shop, Vinyl Records, Regional Assembly of Text, and Twig and Hottie to receive fabulous discounts. So become a CITR member, get a free friends card, and feel the love.
Hello, we're back on Radio Freethinker, and look what the cat dragged in.
Sorry, guys. You know, as you all know, we'll mention this later, I have a debate tonight about why we should eat meat. So in preparation for that, I thought I'd try out the vegan-type diet, and you know, it just left me with so little energy, I couldn't get here on time.
Zing.
But at least that's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
Well, that's quite a tie you got on there.
Yes, it is. Everyone in our radio audience, do you like my tie? I'm sure you can see it.
Hold it up to the microphone so they can see
it. Yes, sorry.
It's very patriotic.
Yeah. Well, speaking of the Red Sea, get it? Because their tie is red. And
uh-huh.
Yes, I'm very clever.
That, of course, a joke only those of us in the studio will know.
Well, that's
true. Because although you said it was patriotic, I have a Canadian flag on my tie.
Yeah.
That's the
it
red.
Is red.
Ergo, the Red Sea reference.
Well, the Canadian flag is red, so they... Whatever.
How did you guys survive?
There's also a part in the middle.
Yeah.
It's not red.
Sure. Okay. That's stop stealing my thunder. So there's a story going around the internet suggesting that computer simulations have shown how wind could have parted the Red Seas. So you guys remember Exodus, where the Jews are fleeing Egypt, but they get to the Red Sea and Pharaoh's armies are chasing them, so Moses parts the Red Sea and everyone runs along the seabed, and then they have to get to the other side, but then when Egypt's forces try to chase them, the water comes back in and they flood away Egypt's finest?
Yes, in fact, when the movie Moses was made, that was a huge special effect where they did that. It was groundbreaking at the time. But, of course, it was easy for Moses to do because he had God on his side.
Sure. Well, according to a computer simulation by the U.S. National Center for Atmospheric Research...
Don't they have anything better to do?
We'll get to that in a minute. Don't jump the gun. Parting the sea may have been possible using wind. Researchers have shown that a strong east wind blowing overnight could have pushed water back at a bend where an ancient river is believed to have merged with a coastal lagoon. So this is not actually referring to the Red Sea, but more on that later. So with the water pushed back into both waterways, a land bridge would have opened at the bend, enabling people to walk across the mudflats to safety. As soon as the wind would die down, the waters would have rushed back in. The study is based on a reconstruction of the likely locations and depths of the Nile Delta waterways, which have shifted considerably over time. So this is not the Red Sea traditionally. This is a different location.
What kind of winds are we talking about here? Like 100 kilometer per hour winds, hurricane force winds?
The quoted in the study is 63 miles per hour wind.
Oh, that's not too crazy.
Well, no, actually, I've heard this story going back from at least the 80s, where this wind theory, and if it's like at a low or high tide, I forget which is the good one, you know, it lowers the local water table. But I mean, whether you can do this in theory is very small, because I mean, all the other issues with regards to
right. I mean, like when I first read this, I kind of went, well, that sounds kind of strange, water. But I mean, water does have, or wind does have a big effect on water. I mean, it can produce some pretty big waves and, you know, hurricanes and all that kind of stuff. So that's not that out of the question. I mean, the amount of wind necessary is where I have a big question mark, among other places. I mean, I can imagine it moving water on the surface, but water below the surface, below deep, a couple, you know, however deep this body of water is. I mean, if it is shallow, like it would suggest it being a delta, then it seems pretty, but then can you just walk across it anyway?
Well, actually, yeah. See, there is one thing that could play into this, but it doesn't play with the geology. I know in England, in particular the eastern part of England, there's a lot of marshland, right? And the water level varies, and there are certain paths, if you know how. And there's actually been historical evidence where you've had sort of robber barons or, you know, outlaw type groups, right, from the king, who've evaded capture because they know the right path through the marshland and these other people didn't. But that doesn't seem, I mean, that could be, if you think Moses was like 50 guys, you know, and the army that went after him was maybe another 50 guys, right?
Yeah.
But still, it doesn't quite...
Right. I mean, and it also kind of sidesteps one of the other problems, which, for example, Exodus never happened. Way back in episode number 3, we discussed how there was no evidence for a mass migration of Jewish slaves from Egypt. And for some reason, the mainstream media never picked up on that story.
No. You know, it's funny, too, though. I mean, this does lead some evidence to the idea that the Bible stories are just that. You know, they're taking little bits because, I mean, maybe someone somewhere evaded capture by going through this sort of
point. Right?
So he said, hey, that's a great idea. I'm going to add this to this great novel I'm writing called The Bible.
Right. The study's lead author, Carl Drews, is quoted as saying, quote, the simulations match fairly closely with the account in Exodus. Now, when I read that, I'm like, well, okay. Could it be that this guy has no interest in proving the literal truth of Exodus, but some journalist wanted an angle, so they threw this in there? Well, actually, no. It turns out Carl Drews is a Bible literalist. He has a personal website which begins with this line. The matters we study here deal with life and death, salvation and eternal life. It is entirely appropriate and necessary that we begin by praying to God. If you are a non-believer, you may skip this section. Which is nice, I guess.
He's just looking out for us.
Drews is using science to try to prove biblical stories, and that's fine, but he's doing it via the National Science Foundation, which means he's using federally funded research, attempting to demonstrate this theory that he first described in his master thesis, that some low-lying riverbed in ancient Egypt could have been powered by heavy sea breezes 2,000 years ago. So I think there's two levels to this. A, the science behind it, the wind parting water is interesting, probably couldn't part a huge body of water. Number two, there's the matter of using federal funded research to prove the, you know, literal truth of the Bible.
Is it possible that maybe, and I hate to give, you know, New Earth creationists or anything like that, Bible literists, any credence, but maybe what he's done is his real scientific research is to create the model. And he says, well, I need to test the model. How can I test this model? Oh, here's an idea to test the model. Mm-hmm. So although it was used in this instance to, in theory, you know, prove it, but really what he was proving was that his model can represent...
Well, he is a legitimate scientist. I looked up some of his research, and he's written several papers that have nothing to do with religion. I think this is an example, though, of somebody letting their personal beliefs influence their current research, and I think that he's being a bit, dishonest. If at the very least, he's taking federal-funded research money and using it to fund biblical research.
So maybe, and this relates to our last episode, if he had to bounce this idea through the government before he was allowed to talk to the press to put the spin on it. You know, as if the government somehow forced scientists to contact them before they contacted the press, like they do here.
Hmm.
Is this an American study or a Canadian?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
The whatchamacallit? The research foundation is one of the biggest scientific research foundations in America. They fund a lot of the research there. So it is kind of annoying when you see this coming out of them. But an interesting nonetheless, and I encourage you to check out the links on our webpage, and you'll have to be able to see a really crappy video of water slowly parting because of wind.
Awesome.
Right. And speaking of water, right,
yeah,
Daniel?
It's oil-filled water.
Sure, why not?
In case you haven't heard, now apparently the big Gulf oil spill has finally been plugged forever and ever. And no more oil will apparently leak out of it. This happened just a few days ago. Actually, maybe about a week ago now. but there's still a lot of issues that go along with the oil spill. There's still a lot of oil that leaked out. And some new estimates are saying that it's, well, a lot more than originally thought, but even quite a bit more than some of the worst case estimates, official estimates from the government. And so now it's believed that there's up to 4.4 million barrels leaked out into the Gulf. That's larger than the official estimate of 4.1 million, which came much later. The original estimates were way, way lower than that.
A lot of those estimates, from what I understand, too, were based on, well, I'm going to call them near-surface drilling rigs, because one of the big issues is this is so deep in the water. And a lot of the scientists, whatever, or the people involved, say one of the reasons why we can't get an accurate measurement of how much oil's actually gone out there is it might actually be so deep down and pooled in areas that it's just not visible as it would be under quote-unquote normal circumstance.
Yeah, there was also lots of issues about getting instruments down there that might be able to record, or not record, but to figure out how much oil is coming out, because the oil as it comes out is very mineral dense and very, very hot, and this would destroy most of the instruments scientists would use to measure it. So that kept a lot of good information out. But there was a technique that's been known for a while and could have been used almost initially right after the oil well burst by using basically just video, high-definition video, and then analyzing it that way to determine how much oil is coming out. And now, it's not as good as having actual instruments measuring it, but it's a lot better than sort of the guesses based off of oil on the surface.
Well, I had heard, and yes, I know the answer to this question, but I had heard that they had a 24-hour video feed almost from day one, but it was of poor quality.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, with poor quality video feed, you can't accurately tell the volume of oil coming out of it.
But boom, 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 and I hate to be a conspiracy nut here. Apparently, BP had all along a high-quality video stream. They just didn't let anyone know about it for a couple of weeks.
Yeah, exactly.
They forgot.
That's how these researchers eventually used this technique. They they requested HD video, and they eventually got it. I believe it was only about a minute of HD video, but it was enough to figure out how much volume would come out in a minute and then extrapolate that over longer time periods.
Has there been any news on how they're going to clean up? Is there any more news about how they're going to keep cleaning up?
Right now? Not anything specific. There's still, I mean, BP will still tell you they're putting lots and lots of money into cleanup efforts. But the one other interesting thing that would have come from this, if this technique was used as soon as possible, is the techniques to clean it up might have been a lot more effective early on, because they would have been based off of much more accurate estimates of the amount of oil coming out. So early estimates were much, much less. We're talking like 100 times less volume coming out than what the newer estimates have. So early cleanup techniques were not properly dealing with the scope of the problem.
You know,
does this mean that we need to take a look at how we're going to fix the environmental and the cleanup problems for the Gulf?
I know one thing that I heard a lot about in the sort of the post-spill thing were a number of scientists who first said, oh, well, we're scrambling to get sort of research teams in there to take, you know, advantage of this research opportunity, and they kind of apologize for saying advantage, but it's like, you know, this happens once in a while, and we can't do it on purpose. But one of the things that I heard come up with is a number of the groups are getting together to sort of do a pre-planning, and apparently they tried to do this before, but there was no funding for it. But now, because of this particular leak, so they're going to sort of have a SWAT team ready. So if something like this happens, they have all it planned out to say, boom, go up and do the research and what kind of research we should do at the time. Whereas this time, apparently, it was just ad hoc from scratch saying, hey, it's a great opportunity.
Yeah, I don't think there's a ton that can be done differently now that this information is finally coming out. It's a little too long, but yeah, it definitely for future oil well bursts. Hopefully there aren't any, but I mean, chances are eventually there's going to be something like this again. It will definitely help deal with those when they happen.
There's two other things that kind of came out of this, one sort of bad, one sort of good, but either way, you know, you want to apply a scientific method to it. One of the complaints that people had with BP was the excessive use, or some people say excessive use, of oil dispersants, which doesn't get rid of the oil, it just breaks up into smaller bits so you can't see it. It's still there, it's just harder to see. But the dispersants themselves are considered to be quite toxic to the environment. And everyone says, well, you shouldn't use them because you're going to cause all sorts of damage. And, well, now we've kind of got a test case. I mean, BP used it whether we wanted them to or not, and we can now start measuring what's going to be the effect on the Gulf Stream. The other aspect, which again is, you know, making lemonade out of lemons, is there's been a lot of research I've been hearing about that's been talking about the growth of oil-eating bacteria, which do exist in nature, right? I mean, oil is part of the environment, usually small part, but it's there, and how because of this oil leak, there's sort of been a boom in their growth, an unexpected boom in their growth, although that could again be BP spin, but science will eventually prove out one way or the other. But I mean, so we are learning a lot of different things from this. It's just a shame we have to learn it.
Yeah, sure. I should also point out that this is the first independent and peer-reviewed estimate of the oil leak, so it took a long time before independent analysis was allowed.
But science is slow.
Yes.
Because if it was quick, then it probably wouldn't be very effective.
No. Unfortunately, regulation is slow, too, because from what I also understand is all the regulatory issues that created the conditions for this to happen in the first place aren't really going to be changed yet and may never get changed. So scientists may get another opportunity to test this out again.
Well, how nice for them.
Yay!
Well, why don't we take a commercial break on Radio Free Thinker? I'll be back with some more after this.
Robots need love, too.
This is Dan Mangan, and you are listening to CITR 101.9 in Vancouver and the surrounding university area.
They want to be loved by robots, need love too. They want to be loved by you.
Yeah, the state of hip-hop right now, man, as far as the way I see it, I think right now, hip-hop is advancing as far as skills. You got brothers, you know what I'm saying, getting, like, more witty.
There ain't nobody to be pretty for. Let it rattle. Let the clatter kill him. Let the cataclysm wash. Who really listens? Precision with a verse draws a cry. Draw a line between an easy melody and peace of mind.
Uh-huh. You got DJs doing all kind of crazy shit on the turntables. I like where it's going, and I like, you know what I'm saying, the creative process that brothers is trying to take it to right now.
Rally Rails and Bread and Butter in the place to be. Crimes and Treasons Radio, 101.9 FM, Vancouver, CITR.ca, every Tuesday, 9 till 11.
Dynamite!
We're back on Radio Free Thinker, so we're going to be talking a bit about guns, specifically long guns. What is a long gun?
And not short gun.
No.
basically, it's rifles, so the kind commonly used for hunting in Canada, as well as shotguns, also commonly used for hunting, generally birds. It does not include things like machine guns, which are restricted in Canada. Actually, no, they're prohibited in Canada. or something like an assault rifle that fires automatic. So that's not what we're talking about here.
Even though they are, in fact, quite long.
Yes. They well, technically, you could argue they're long guns, but they're not the long guns that this law deals with.
Oh, so, I see. Okay, right.
Would a semi-automatic Uzi qualify? Because they're kind of smaller.
They are also prohibited in Canada.
Semi-automatics? I know automatics are restricted, but...
I believe any Uzi would be restricted. You can get something...
It's anti-Semitism, I tell you.
I believe you can get something like an AK-47 as long as it's switched to only do semi-auto.
Well, no. Actually, if you ever look in gun magazines, there's this huge culture of converting your semi-automatic to automatic because you need to protect liberty with high-powered machine guns because low-powered machine guns just won't kill them fast enough or something.
Yeah, that's more of the Texas way. But back to Canada. So just to give you a little background on the long gun registry and the vote. So a few days ago, the Parliament finally voted on this, and they voted to stop a bill going through Parliament that would have ended the long gun registry. The vote was very close. It was 153-151. Before this vote happened, there was actually a belief that it would not pass, so the long gun registry might actually have ended. But at the last minute, some NDP and Liberal voters, or NDP and Liberal members of Parliament, changed their minds.
So this was a vote to repeal the registration.
No, sorry. Okay, it's kind of complicated. It's a vote to end another bill that would have repealed the legislation.
So long story short, the registration stays.
Yes.
Okay.
So
yes.
The Liberals and Bloc Québécois voted to... keep the long gun registry, and the Conservatives against and the NDP were split, mostly along urban versus rural riding.
Yeah, you know, and it's such an odd way this sort of defines, you know, like you have, now it seems the Liberals are the city party, the Bloc seems to be the city party, because I'm assuming Quebec farmers are not that much different from Ontario farmers, maybe, but...
There's actually slight differences. Generally, Quebecers are a little more anti-gun registry than the rest of Canada, but, yeah, for the most part, it's pretty similar.
I always find it bizarre that sometimes Quebecers are more Canadian than Canadians, but that's a whole other issue. But no, actually, I was reading somewhere that one of the things is urban divide issue. That the reason why Harper is pushing this isn't because he's going to win any votes, because it's as you say, it's pretty strict. You know, who's going to vote is going to vote either way. But the one party that will suffer from this is the NDP, and they figure that's where they can actually hurt the whole demographic.
It's possible. If you're looking at it from Harper's point of view, it kind of does look a little weird why he'd do this, because the chance for gaining many votes seems pretty limited, but...
This is already pretty well-understood political theory. Let's move on to the science part
of this. just for some interesting tidbits before I move on to more of the long gun registry, Harper has led his government towards an end to this three times. But when he was in a different party, he actually voted for the long gun registry twice. So I just found that
different
kind of
party.
Funny.
You mean when he was a Liberal?
A reformer, which was somewhere
which
in between.
Which is not a Liberal at all.
But yeah, anyway, back to more of the facts of the long gun registry itself. So in 2008, there were 24 homicide deaths caused by long guns. So that would be that includes things like sawed-off rifles and shotguns, which I believe are technically illegal in Canada.
Were those deaths limited to any particular province or region? Or
no, that's all of Canada.
Okay.
In terms of total number of homicides, it's a lot more than that, but that's just the ones.
No, I understand that. Yeah.
And the long gun registry is accessed around 11,000 times per day. So this is when a police officer is, say, responding to a call at a household. He can type in the address into his computer, and he will get the info on whether there's any registered guns in that house.
Mm-hmm.
So of police associations, 154 of the 160 support the long gun registry, and 6 oppose it. So it's fairly unanimous between with police officers that they support the registry. And in terms of cost, cost is often this really, really thing thrown around by people against it, as it's a horribly expensive program. But in terms of its running cost now, it's relatively cheap. It's far less than $100 million per year. But the exact cost is, no one really knows. Everywhere I went, there's a different number for it. And people like the Auditor General have said it's very hard to determine the exact cost, but it's peanuts compared to the federal budget as a whole. So arguing that it's a great way to sort of cut the deficit is ridiculous. And the number of registered weapons across Canada right now is 7.5 million. About half a million of those are handguns, which don't fall under the long gun registry, and then about 7 million of them are long guns.
Wow.
So is that, would you say then that it's about 7 million Canadians have long guns, or is it like somebody has a gun collection and they have like 8?
Yeah, it's actually, I believe the number, it's 2.5 to 3 million Canadian households that have guns in them. So the average in Canada is if you have a gun, you're likely to have two or more at least.
Okay.
So just some history on gun control in Canada briefly. Since 1892, a permit has been required to buy pistols. And since 1934, registration with the government has been required for all pistols and restricted weapons.
Now, when I was reading your notes, I wasn't quite sure. One of the delineations that I had heard about this issue was, if I want to get a gun, I need to register myself. But I don't need to register the guns that I am purchasing. So although I have to say, hey, I'm a gun owner, that the gun, one of the unique things about the gun registry is that it doesn't care about me per se, but it cares about the guns.
That's not how it works anymore. It does link the guns to an owner. So unless I'm misunderstanding what you're saying.
Historically.
Oh, historically, yeah. Historically, you'd basically just need a license to buy the guns, and then the government did not keep track of who had the guns, where the guns were, that kind of thing. For pistols, they've done that for most of the time Canada has been a country. Pistols have been registered like that. But for long guns, it's relatively new, within the last decade. And so during World War II, it was actually necessary to register all weapons. This was largely an anti-spy measure, anti-insurgency within the country. But that went away after World War II. And then so in 2003, the modern long gun registry started. Before we get too much into the debates, the arguments for both sides, and then sort of whether there's factual merit to them, I just want to point out quickly what the gun registry is and what it isn't, because both sides often end up arguing for other things than the gun registry itself. So the gun registry provides the RCMP with a searchable database of connecting people with households with guns. So basically if the RCMP wants to look up if an individual has a registered gun, they can. If they want to look up whether a household has guns in it, they can. It is occasionally also used to take guns from people. So if someone, if a court believes that someone might commit a crime, they can use the registry to figure out if they have a gun, and then a court order can be used to take away that gun. But it is not a strict limit on who can buy guns. Any limits on that is done by other people. So in that sense, it's not gun control like typically thought of. It's not limiting who can have guns or limiting the number of guns specifically. It might be an added consequence by making it slightly more annoying to get guns, but it's not specifically trying to take guns away. So I guess I'll get into the arguments for the long gun registry.
Well, I have a couple questions. So. So the idea, I guess, behind registering guns like this is that it's supposed to be either a crime deterrent or to assist in solving crimes?
The point of it is to provide police with more knowledge about whether a criminal might have weapons, partly. And it's also to keep Canadians more accountable for guns they own. Also, like, theoretically, it's a way to keep guns out of criminals' hands, although that's very dubious, as we'll get into later.
So was there an incident or was there a cause that made people say, okay, we need to start registering these guns because our police officers are getting, you know, shot by shotguns, expecting to, for like a standard domestic dispute, or was there, is there a reason that people said we need this?
There wasn't anything specific. I mean, there have been some school shootings, although I don't believe there was anyone right around the time this was passed. I could be wrong on that.
Actually, yeah. One of the big things that pushed this, and one of the reasons why the Bloc is slowly behind it, is École Polytechnique, where 14 women were shot. Right. And then they had Concordia massacre, again, in Quebec, right? And both of those were, I believe, with long guns. And also the Columbine, right, which wasn't a Canadian incident, but it was one of those things that added to the whole zeitgeist, if I can use that term.
Sure.
So part of it is, you know, long guns are dangerous, which goes against a traditional view in Canada. I don't know if I'm jumping ahead here, but one of the pushbacks for this and why it's favored amongst conservatives is if you ever go on a farm, they have gophers.
You've
got a gun all the time. And it's considered to be a hassle. And honestly, considering all the other paperwork farmers go through, I don't think it's that big of a hassle. But it's an added hassle for them to try and register these guns. And they say, well, it's part of our life, and you city folk just don't understand what it's like. But you're pointing out that one of the things the police department says is it likes to know when they're walking into a particular scene, what can they expect in that house? On the flip side of that, and again, one of the reasons to support it, is if this gun is registered to you, there's an extra incentive for you to make sure you're accountable for the whereabouts of that gun. You know, you can't just let it lie around, or you can't just lend it to your friends, or say, oh, I think it's locked up, I'm not too sure. I mean, it's not a huge incentive, but it is an incentive to make it more responsible and keep the guns out of the on improper hands. Nothing's perfect, but...
Yeah, probably one of the most obvious cases for its use in giving police extra intelligence when going to a situation is for domestic cases. So someone gets called in because... or police get called in because neighbors hear their neighbors yelling. They can quickly check to see if there's guns in that household, and it might change the way they respond to that call. There might be more imminent danger or potential for a hostage taking or someone getting shot.
Yeah, that seems like a perfectly really good reason to have it right there. So what let's get into the arguments then. So why would we suggest that it's not a good thing?
All right, well, you jumped ahead a little bit.
Sorry.
About the ones for it. So obviously the police, giving police knowledge is one of them. As Don mentioned, it also... theoretically, at least, provides more of an incentive for people to figure out, or to keep track of their guns, to report them if they're stolen, that kind of thing. But there may be some issues with that, because there's no real good evidence that skipped ahead here. Okay, for that one, the real question is, so to what extent should people be responsible for their stolen property? If someone steals your car and then runs over someone with it, is that your fault? They did use your car. And so sort of for the same thing, you can look at it with guns. Is it really your fault if someone steals something from your house and kills someone with it, regardless of what it is?
I think there's a flaw in that argument, because cars are used for other things other than killing people or killing anything, whereas guns have, like, a very specific use. They, you know, they're for hunting, or they're for other things than
killing.
Death.
Actually, I think a more appropriate analogy to use your car thing is, what does your insurance car company say if you say, well, I left the keys running at Walmart when I went in to grab my eggs? They'd say, well, that makes you responsible for the car being stolen, right? It doesn't necessarily mean you can, because as Chloe mentioned...
Well maybe even a better analogy would be, suppose me and Daniel are out and he gets drunk and I lend him my car keys. Like, does that make me responsible if Daniel runs over somebody and flies through the windshield or something?
Well, my problem was wasn't so much with the analogy, but the idea of guns as property. Yes, you are more responsible, I think, for a gun than for a car or for your car keys because of the damage that a gun can do.
But
for example,
arguably, and I bet you if you, I don't have the statistics for this in front of me, but I bet you if you looked at the statistics, deaths caused by stolen cars is probably much, much higher than deaths caused by stolen weapons.
This is very true.
Like, I'm talking
but,
like...
But, okay, yes, but then deaths by cars in general are greater than guns in general, too. So,
yeah.
I think part of that's the prevalence, as Chloe was mentioning. I mean, there is a secondary use for a car that is perfectly valid. In fact, better than that, the primary use for a car isn't to run over people. In fact, if you run over a person with a car, stolen or otherwise, oops, right? It was not usually even your intent. Whereas with a gun, I mean, A, when you buy the gun, the whole point of the gun is to shoot at something. That is why you bought it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, small number of collectors out there might have bought it not to shoot at things. But I think what she's going for is there is an added level of responsibility. And the fact that you are responsible for that gun, if it gets stolen, you phone up the cops, say, hey, my gun has been stolen. That goes into the registry too, right? So, I mean, they say, okay, he reported the gun. He reported promptly, we hope. And then it's no longer his gun that he's registered to, right? And the tie is broke. But, I mean, if he sits there and someone's, I'm not sure where the gun is. Maybe I let it to Frank. Maybe not, right? You know, you're gonna get on top of that.
I think one of the major reasons for this is in the past, people who've actually given their guns to criminals just claim that they stole them. So I think this provides sort of another way to charge that person. Whether you like that or not, it's a whole other question. But I think that's part of the reason for it.
I also think on this note, because there may be areas to improve this. I mean, I remember I was listening to a discussion about this on the agenda. And the police chief, the leader of the police chiefs of Canada, forget exactly his title, you know, reiterated the saying, you know, yes, there are some issues that could be improved upon, but I mean, there are some issues that can be improved upon anything. That doesn't mean you get rid of the whole thing.
Yeah.
So, also another key argument is either this or variations of this. Basically, it's worth it even if it saves one life. Not everyone might be so much with the one life thing, but say it's worth it if it saves a few lives, 10 lives, etc.
24.
Or 24. And I'll get into that after. So the problem with this is it's basically a non-falsifiable argument. So it's hard for skeptics to really look at this. First off, it'd be hard to prove that this actually saved any lives. Because that would basically require require looking into the future, which is pretty much impossible to do. But it's also impossible to falsify because it could always save someone in the future. And so there's issues to this. No doubt human life is important and we should look to save it, but this idea, you could justify pretty much anything on the basis that if one life saves it, that it's all good.
I actually have a question. Do you know the numbers in terms of since the gun registry was implemented in 2003?
Oh, stealing my comment.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Do you know if there has been any decrease in homicide deaths as a result of a long gun?
I know that the...
Or does anyone else at the table?
The homicide rate in Canada has been falling for decades, and it continued falling after the gun registry went into place. But so there's definitely a correlation if you look at the data over that period of time. The problem is, and I could be totally wrong on this, I tried my best to find any like actual study that sort of did something to control for other factors, and I couldn't find anything. But to me, it looks like it's peer correlation. It just happened to come into place as the crime rate was already falling.
Well, there's so many factors contributing to the fall of crime. I mean, this might be a small factor, but it's really hard to determine what percentage of a factor this is.
Which, of course, shows one of the issues of the scientific method, especially when you kind of stretch its limits, as we're doing, to take it to more political issues, is confounding variables in there, right? Yeah, I mean, right. You know, maybe it was a bad economy caused an increase in murders, but global warming caused a decrease in the rise of pudding pops.
Yeah, if say each province was given the opportunity to say yes or no to this, and some agreed to having the long gun registry and some were against it, then you might be able to determine something about its effectiveness. But because that didn't happen, it's basically impossible to look at Canadian statistics and determine specifically whether the long gun registry has actually lowered the homicide rate.
I mean, could we possibly look to other nations? I mean, maybe not America, because, you know, but maybe like Australia or Germany or France or something?
Yeah. So one of the arguments against the long gun registry is that, in general, gun control does little or nothing. And this is generally supported from statistical evidence. And let me put a few caveats on this. Generally, this statistical evidence is of sort of moderate gun control. So nothing like the Australian full ban on guns or stuff like that. It's going from a country with a decent number of guns to limiting their availability or limiting number of guns in total. Nothing drastic, and also nothing like the initial steps taken, like limiting people's criminal record to buying guns. That likely does have some effect. So in those cases, crime is almost entirely uncorrelated with gun control. Mm-hmm. And so this is largely based off of U.S. stuff, comparing regions, comparing states, comparing parts of cities even, with the availability of guns and the crime rate. And there's very little correlation.
So you're mentioning crime there, but what about like gun-related injuries? It's just pure accidents, like I accidentally shot you or something.
For the most part, those are uncorrelated. The only one that has a strong correlation is suicide, gun-related suicides. But generally, the total suicide rate is unaffected. It only changes the percentage used with guns. So if guns are more available, more people kill themselves with guns. If the guns aren't available, they find other ways to kill themselves.
Which, oddly enough, explains the high suicide rate in Switzerland, which has the second highest gun ownership in the world. I was freaked when I heard that. Sorry, that was just
Possibly. it's sort of just meaningless statistics until someone analyzes it more. Although, from what I've heard, actually, if you look at inter-country models, trying to figure out if there's some relation to gun ownership and gun crime rates, Switzerland is definitely refutes any claim that gun ownership leads to higher gun crime rates, because it has ridiculously high gun ownership rates and very, very little gun crime.
Yeah, on a sort of tangential but ending note, maybe. One of the things I thought was surprising, I heard a statistic that said something like 18 or so percent of voters said that this issue will change the way they vote in the election. And, you know, I was sitting there thinking to myself, you know, I have a position on the gun registry. I think it's one thing. But I don't think it's the most pressing issue that's facing this nation right now. And I mean, even if Harper said, I love the gun registry, and the Socialist Party of Canada said, we're going to give everyone a gun and we hope you all shoot each other, that's not going to change how I'm going
that
to
might
vote.
Change my mind, actually.
Well, no, I don't know. I was struck by how single issue some politics have gotten, and how this gun registry is such a reflection of that, you know?
Well, I think Daniel kind of mentioned this at the beginning. There's so much confusion over what we're talking about when we talk about gun registry. You know, this is not talking about banning guns. This is just about attaching a number and a name to a gun. I mean, I think people get so worked up over these ideological ideas around guns instead of looking at what we're actually talking about.
Yeah, it's true. Guns are sort of like, it's an easy object of fear. So that can definitely lead to some irrational thinking around it. We're running out of time, so I won't get too much into that. But I just want to really quickly go through a few of the other common arguments against the long gun registry, because I only really talked about one. One is that it violates legal and privacy rights of gun owners, who are roughly about 25% of the population. It definitely does to some extent. There's no real debating this. But
it violates it as much as me getting a registration for a car. I mean,
yeah, but I mean, certainly, it depends on your opinion of whether people should have a right to a gun. But it's not really something you can easily look at skeptically.
Well, I mean, it's also like, yeah, if you think that your gun is part of your duty to make the government accountable, then it's going to stick in your craw.
No, I'm going to stop you. We don't have a Second Amendment in this country, right?
No, I realize that.
We don't have a right to guns. But, so although you're right, someone may feel that it's a thing. Rationally speaking, there is no logical difference between me having to register my car and you having to register your gun. And although it is conceivable if I owned a farm, I don't have to register a car on the farm, guns are a different sort of, they're a special item in society because they kill.
Definitely, but just because the current legal climate doesn't provide that right doesn't mean some people might not wish they have a right. And as I'm saying here, it's not a skeptical argument. You can't look at it skeptically. It's up to each individual to decide whether they believe people should have a right and then weigh it against benefits and costs otherwise. One other quick one is that a lot of the time people argue against the long gun registry by saying criminals won't use registered guns. They'll use stolen registered guns, and so it's completely pointless in stopping criminals from committing crimes with guns. And there's something to this. A lot of criminals don't use registered guns, and for the most part they use handguns, which legally have been required to register since 1936, and very few of the ones used in street crime are registered. So obviously registration is not a perfect stop to gun crime, but some criminals, and this is coming from a survey that's US-based, about 15-20% actually say they do register guns. So some criminals do, seemingly, but some don't. So you do have to keep that in mind when you're talking about the gun registry. It's not going to provide a legal connection with guns to every criminal.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe we're pretty much out of time, so I'll try and post a blog post with more of this stuff up on our website at some point.
Sure. Let's go to a quick commercial break, and we'll be back with our skeptical highlights for the day.
Are you a UBC student taking first-year economics, math, chemistry, or physics?
That stuff is hard.
Are you feeling like you need some tutoring? That's okay, because the AMS offers free and appointment tutoring for students in these subjects.
Whoa! How does it work?
It's on a first-come, first-served basis, and there's no need to sign up. Just show up with your books and your questions.
Whoa! When does it happen?
Monday to Thursday from 3 to 7 at the Sub Pacific Spirit Cafeteria, located beside the Starbucks.
Whoa! A+, here I come.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker. And the stupid... there it goes. I love our technology here at CITR. Anyway, let's go into our skeptical highs because we're almost out of time. And so today, is there anything happening today, Don?
Well, yeah, I guess I should whore myself out for my own event. Tonight I'm doing a debate with Dr. Rob Tarswell, who is going to say that you shouldn't eat meat. Well, I'm going to take that sucker down! In a intellectual and stimulating way.
You're just going to tackle him on the stage. That's at 7 p.m. at Langara College, and that's in room A130. Please join us. Tickets are $5, $4 for students, and free for CFI members. I also have a skeptical highlight, and that's taking place on Thursday. CFI is continuing our Skeptics in the Pub in Richmond. We have a new date, which is Thursday, the last Thursday of the month at 7:30, Legends Pub, which is just a short walk from the Brinkhouse SkyTrain station, so please join us.
And oops, the UBC Freethinkers General Meeting plus watching Skeptical Simpsons episodes is on at the same time as Skeptics in the Pub. But if you're a student at UBC interested in the UBC Freethinkers, definitely check it out. It's 7 to 9 p.m. Buchanan B213, and that's this Thursday.
Well, they're on, geographically different areas. Yeah. So, I mean, pick which is closest to you.
Yeah, and in the future, we definitely won't have stuff during Skeptics in the Pubs, because a lot of our members like to go to those. But for this one, we do. Definitely come out if you want to have a say in the future of the club this year.
Excellent. Any other skeptical highlights? No, that's it. Okay, well, we're wrapping up here on Radio Free Thinker. I do encourage our listeners to check out our webpage at www.radiofreethinker.com. You can become our fan or like or whatever it is on Facebook, and you can follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. This is Ethan, your freethinking historian and executive director of CFI Vancouver, saying thanks for listening.
And this is Don saying, I'm going to take that sucker down.
This is Chloe. I don't like violence.
This is Daniel saying, I'm kind of scared of Dawn now.
So long, everybody.
Yeah, the state of hip-hop right now, man, as far as the way I see it.